Hey, can you guys quit looking at fucking boobs and can you restart your Discord web session and can you see if it launches correctly? If it does, I'm gonna reboot. If it doesn't, we're gonna use Skype. Hashtag quit looking at boobs.
Documented on this show a bit has been some of the troubles we've had recently with our Arch GNOME setups. And I don't think it's GNOME. I don't necessarily think it's Arch. I think it's something in between in the whole stack that's causing problems. And so really we've come down to, let's move away from GNOME 3 in production. It's a good desktop. I love it. But I don't need anything that fancy for our production. And then one of the nice things about Linux is you have the flexibility to go with something simpler if that's what you want. And I've been mulling this over, and I cannot frickin' believe where I think I'm going with this. This is not Chris coming out as anti-rolling. This is Chris saying, now that I'm not installing software on a daily basis, and now that OBS has gotten to a sort of a feature complete level where we don't constantly need to be running the absolute latest build from Git, the necessity for Arch in production is receding, and the necessity for stability is encroaching. And I feel like I'm in a spot right now where I'm ready to swap out some of our rolling stuff for tried, true, stable LTS. Get ready for it. And I'm not saying this to be like, this is just how I feel. I know how this is going to sound. Running Unity 7.
Okay, I was with you up until you said, why Unity 7?
Because it's the best Linux desktop for what we need to do, I swear. I mean, we've been having zero troubles with this Skype machine. It's just very simple and efficient. I just need a couple of buttons on the side.
Except for the NVIDIA settings resetting.
Yeah, I know, but I don't necessarily feel like that's Unity's fault, though.
Well, it's not, because it's happening in your Arch machine, too.
Yeah, exactly. and it's so smooth, Noah. Like, the windows just render super quick. It looks good enough. The text is clear enough to read. It hasn't crashed once. And then you combine it with the live patch service, which really sort of is the cross-section of, I don't want to be that guy who runs systems that are years out of date, but I also need something that's super rock-solid, appliance-level steady, that can run 24/7 and is ready for production at any moment because we have crazy recording schedules. And I swear, to me, sitting back now, if I can get OBS that we need and versions of FFmpeg that we need working on Ubuntu 16.04, and then I combine that with the nice, solid, not-changing Unity 7 that isn't XFCE and the live patch service, I just don't see how that's not a total win for a production system.
I'm just glad that you're using a system that you're going to have to replace in 3 years.
3 years feels like a long time, though, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's true. You probably have wiped Ubuntu in 3 months.
Yeah.
This is what I've been doing in Grand Forks, right? Like, so the day that I bought, and you can go back and look, I don't know how long it's been. It's over a year for sure. But I bought a brand new machine, built it with the help of Rekai, put it into production, installed, 1604 LTS, and I haven't touched it. And I've not had any issues. It just works. And so I have never disputed the fact that there is a large range of software available on Arch. But, and we've had this discussion before, and maybe we'll have it again now, but, you know, I think that, 1604 for the software that is there works very, very well. And here's the other thing. It allows software vendors to target. So, Skype or whatever, it specifically says, 1604, or newer, and they have like this base, like, okay, let's try it on 1604. And then if it works on 1604, should work on everything newer than that. But they don't really know. So they're probably testing on 1604. So I think that's point one. And then the second point is there are a ton of software that is available on Arch, but it doesn't always work. Like, the most notable example in my life lately has been
CFile. Here we go, TeamViewer. Are you going to say TeamViewer?
No, not TeamViewer.
Okay. Good,
CFile.
Good.
CFile?
It's an open source
CFile.
Program.
That's CFile.
CFile client. And the thing about CFile client is that it's an open source client, and it references some sort of library that apparently they update faster than the CFile guys do. And so it's an easy fix. I have to uninstall CFile and reinstall it. But it's a pain to have to keep doing that. And
that's actually a legit example. That is a common thing. It's like, it's not that it's like everything on your Arch system. It's that one thing on your Arch system.
Or one or two things. And it's not even that they're not fixable. Lightwork, same thing. There's weird things that happen. If you go to the AUR, there's a little fix, and you install this thing or uninstall app package or whatever, and it works. So it's not like you can't get over them. There are problems and you solve them. I wouldn't even go as far as to say that there are more problems on Arch than there are on other distros. It's just I'm solving different problems. But I don't have those issues on 1604. So if all the software you need is available on Ubuntu 1604, yeah, I believe that you can install it. You'll have it once and you won't have to touch the box. You can update it every so often and you can trust that when you update it. I've never had anything break on an update on an Ubuntu box.
Yeah, I think, talking about updates, part of what is motivating this switch isn't so much that like something's immediately broken. It's that our Anagross machines, which some of these are based off of for just ease of installation and speed, seems to fuck its keys up every couple of weeks. Like, legitimately,
Package keys.
Yeah, package keys. For the last couple of weeks, I've just been taking screenshots and sending them to Rekai and being like, look, it's fucked up again. It's been 6 days, Rekai, and the keys are already screwed up again. And I've done nothing but Pac-Man SYU. And
yeah, and every time it happens, you have to run like
you can actually disable that.
You can, but
it's just I'm sick of it, dude. And that when you start getting into often the weeds, like disabling package up signature checks and stuff like that, it's starting to feel pretty hackish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think that using Ubuntu is more viable now that they've added snap packages, because you can pretty much get up to date software via the Snap Store now.
Yeah. Flatpaks and snaps do change it a lot. You're right. That does make it easier to run older versions. I went to my first Russian wedding last night, and I know it's not cool right now to like Russians, but these guys, they know how to party, dude. Like, they know how to party good. Smoking, drinking, open bar, all kinds of stuff.
A lot of vodka?
A lot of vodka. A lot of everything.
No, vodka.
Vodka. And a lot of bad music. Thing I need to talk to you guys.
I would like to introduce Dima's friend Alex.
It was weird because like half of the wedding was in English and half of the wedding was in Russian, and so like half of it I had no idea what was going on. But apparently they all have some like word that they shout and then they drink. Do you remember what was it? It was bushka or something like that?
Bushka.
Yeah, bushka. And then they all drink. But I had an awkward thing happen. So this is the first time I had seen family since I made the choice. It's a choice I've talked about here on the show before.
The choice to be a hipster.
Oh my God, Rekai. You are so fired right now. No, but it's kind of yes. The choice to grow out my hair. Yeah, okay. Okay, so the choice to be a hipster. I hate you. And guess what everybody in my family, when they saw me, what they wanted to talk about was how long my hair was. How my hair was long. And it looked fine. Like, you saw it before I left.
I see you right now.
It doesn't look like it looked like last night, right? Like, it was styled, right? It was at least combed last night.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's...
Well, I don't know. You went to a Russian wedding. How long did it stay that way?
Well, it did start to fall down as the...
Because right now, Chris, you look a little bit rough.
Yeah, it was a little rough. There was a lot of drinking. I mean, I didn't, but there's just everybody else was drinking. I couldn't drink because I had to be here today and I didn't want to be all hungover. So I only had one. I had a squirt with tequila. You ever had squirt?
So what you're saying is you partied like a Russian,
yeah,
but you were sober.
Nobody partied like my uncle, though. My uncle, he's reminding me now these days of my grandpa when I was young enough to remember my grandpa as a bit of a younger man, like in his 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so now my uncle reminds me of my grandpa, and he's kind of taken on some of his characteristics. And I'm walking out to leave the party because I've had enough party. And I look over at this table, and it's a smoke-filled table. And it's outside, and they're all just puffing away at cigars. And it's Russians, man, and they're all laughing, and they're telling jokes. And I don't understand a word that's being said. And I look, and one of those Russians is my uncle. And the dude has no idea what any of these Russians are saying with their shirts that are like V-necks with a cut open.
Does it really matter?
Smoking their cigars. He's smoking their cigars the whole time. I gained a new level of respect for my uncle that night.
I feel like it's a peek into your future.
We did, like a month ago, we did this wedding for a couple of Mexican descent. And so they had a lot of their family here. And they kept requesting all of this music, you know, from Mexico. And when I got done, we went back and looked at how much music we bought. And I was like, we spent $150 tonight on music that nobody is ever going to request ever again. Because, like, we didn't even, yeah, like, they had to write it out for us to understand, like, how to get, they really, yeah, should have hired, like,
yeah,
a Mexican
so this
DJ,
guy,
really.
So for people who don't know, surprisingly, one of the things that Noah kind of does a lot for Altus Beat, well, I don't know about a lot, but does successfully for Altus Beat, I'll put it that way, is be a DJ at weddings. And I got a couple of DJ questions for you, Noah, because I feel like you have standing in this space. So you're like, you're a friend of mine I can bounce some of these questions off of. So the first question is, there was like this like standby music the guy played as like people were switching like... Like this, you always played this loop in the background? Yeah, that's normal?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, you usually, here's the thing. Yeah, here, pro tip. There are people that will take a song and they'll speed it up to 120 beats per minute, and then they will put that bass drum behind it, and they will give you a lead in at the beginning and an outro at the end. So Mikhail Willis, he's one of my favorite guys to get music from, but basically he will take like pop songs or whatever the top 20 is, and he will make those, and then you can take those particular cuts and put them in, and then you don't have to play that beat because it's already layered into the song.
Sure.
And so all you have to do is beat match the next song, and then it sounds like it's all one continuous song.
That seems a little smoother than what this guy was doing. I like this guy just had like a loop on a soundboard that he was hitting.
Yeah.
Now, here's another
thing. If you don't get those cuts, or if there isn't a song that has a cut, then you have to play a loop.
Okay, so I got to ask you about this one because I felt like this was going too far, but I don't have any standing, and I want to know your take on it. So after people spoke, he would also hit a applause track. So he was playing fake applause over the house stereo.
Yeah, that's weird. That's really weird.
It felt weird, man.
That is weird.
It was a big wedding, you know. It's like a 200 people wedding. So like,
yeah,
there was
kind of delegitimizes the speech. Then it's kind of like, oh, nobody really cared, so let me play. That's tacky. I would never do that.
I thought it was a bit strange.
Maybe it's just a Russian thing.
Well, I'll tell you, man, they are loud, and I mean this with total love. Like, they know how to party. Like, those Russians are amped up, and like they break off into groups, and they have big tables and gatherings, and they're just shouting back and forth. And so it did feel – the DJ was Russian, too. So it did feel like it was just a little bit of a cultural difference, too.
Yeah.
Maybe they have applause at Russian weddings. I want to talk about something else for a second here. So, you know, this is so Google. It's hilarious. And it plays right into our show. So you know how, like, a few weeks ago, I was looking into Linux in Montana? And I was trying to figure out, like, what's going on and see if Noah and I wanted to talk to anybody while we were in Bozeman. Well, now in my Google Now feed, I have stuff from the Montana Linux users group just automatically showing up. You see that?
Yeah.
And they're blogging about the next Fedora 26 release. And do you, Noah, tell me if you agree with this assessment, because I am sort of generalizing when I say this. But to me, it feels like when you go Midwest to East Coast, what you have is a bunch of Fedora Red Hat people. And so here is the Montana Linux users
group. The closer to the east you get,
group.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, say it again?
You get to the East Coast, that's true. I would say
yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So here is the – yeah, absolutely. Of course, Montana considers themselves the West, but that's kind of funny. It's so adorable. They are blogging about the new release of Fedora before it's even released. Like, as we record right now, Fedora's 26 is being finalized, and it's going to go out for downloads next week and stuff like that. And so here they are blogging about Fedora. And I don't know. There's something interesting about when you get to the middle of the United States and go east. We've really become a Fedora Red Hat community.
I don't think it's an east-west thing. I think it's the further you are from population centers.
Why do you think
that? No, that's not true. That's not true at all. That's not true because that's not true in Pennsylvania. That's not true in New York. That's not true.
Yes, it is.
And all those are – no, it's not. Absolutely not. Those are some of the most diehard Red Hat guys you'll ever find is on the East Coast.
Yeah, I concur with Noah to a degree. I think the more you get to the East, the more Red Hat businessy it gets. And the more you get to the West, the more Debian Ubuntu it gets.
I don't agree with that at all, having been living in the Northeast.
All right. No, I accept. You have some standing here. What do you think?
Like, I feel like the Northeast is actually very heavily Debian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. I mean, I don't really know, so I can't say. But, you know, like when I think of Self and when I think of Montana and when I think of...
Well, Self isn't the Northeast, though.
No, that's true. No, you're right. Yeah, yeah. It's the Southeast.
Okay, fine. So to your point, where the last Fedora thing was, it was in New York. I mean, it just all of the Fedora / Red Hat events seem to occur somewhere in the East, rather Southeast or Northeast. Where's the Red Hat conference this year? The I forget what they call it. They have some weird name for it, but that was in, I think, New York.
Yeah, the Red Hat Summit. It's not that weird, but yeah, yes, you're right. That's an East Coast event. You're right. And see, their headquarters is in North Carolina. Red Hat's is in North Carolina. Raleigh. Yeah.
See, I think it's weird though because New York, what happens there doesn't necessarily reflect what is there. It's just it's so big that people just do things there because it's so big.
Mm. I wonder if people, and I'm not joking, I wonder if some of these tech events like the Red Hat Summit and others aren't going to move, or OSCON, don't move to Vegas. Not only is Vegas super cheap to, well, it's super cheap to travel to. It's easy to book. There's lots of flights coming in and out, and they just legalized pot. And yeah, there is there's a big crossover between the tech community and pot.
I do know that a lot of non-Linux tech-related businesses do their business meetups in Vegas. Like my friend works at GameStop, and she's traveling out to Vegas, I think, in 2 weeks to do their annual company meetup.
As long as it's not August.
The thing is, my understanding is that Vegas is very popular because of all those things that you said, but it's also very competitive, and so they charge a lot to have events at all those, you know, for all those
that
reasons
makes sense,
that you just specified. So if you notice, like, a lot of the large conferences, you know, DEF CON and CES and, NAB is all those are in Las Vegas. But if you look at, you know, like FedCon or whatever, there's no way they're going to do that in Vegas South. There's no way they're doing that in Vegas.
Yeah, that makes sense. It seems like it would be super expensive. That's why you got to sell edibles on the floor. No, I'm kidding. That would be bad. But it does seem like Vegas would, to me, like when you look at travel costs, just look at the ticket prices.
I find it super interesting that a lot of business conventions are in Vegas, but like none of the community.
Because the businesses have money to spend, like Noah's saying.
Well, yeah. But even like the huge conventions, like the public conventions, like Comic-Con, that's not in Vegas. That's in other big cities. And there's a crap ton of events in California and Seattle. It's weird that it's mostly business.
Yeah,
I
suppose.
Weird. I mean, the thing is, Vegas is really structured for I have to work Monday through Friday, so I want to leave because there's a flight every hour to Vegas out of every major city in the country, and I want to land Friday night, and then I want to get to the hotel immediately. Oh, conveniently, the airport is just like a mile and a half from the Strip, so you get in the, and there's a bazillion taxi services and a bazillion shuttles that will take you there, so you can pretty much land, walk down, walk out to the thing, get over to your hotel. Every hotel on the Strip has an event center in it, so you can basically be assured that you can stay at the hotel where the event is. They don't run out of rooms like they do in a lot of other places. I mean, all of that stuff
is tons of capacity.
All the restaurants are right there. Yeah. Everything is – it's just a –
And the transportation. You don't have to worry about like rentals and – yeah. That's why I was saying that. But you're right. I bet it would bring up the average ticket cost. You know, so totally on the other end of the spectrum – we had a barbecue here this week on July 4th as we're recording this, and it went way better than I could have even thought. First of all, Dustin and Adam from Vancouver, they brought half the party with them.
Yeah.
Seriously, like just incredible food skills and dedication to making this an awesome party.
They brought a sous vide machine.
Yeah, man. And just tons of veggies. But also just we got to meet, you know, a lot of really great people. John is a local. He drove up from not too far down, just about 25 miles south from here. But we actually had somebody drive out from Missouri. Mike drove all the way out from Missouri, which is just a phenomenal.
You know, I'm surprised that Noah dude didn't show up. He's closer.
I know, right?
I thought about it. And what ended up keeping me out of there was I had a bunch of family stuff going on the board. So they were like, I talked to my wife about it. She's like, not this time.
Yeah, but you know what, dude? Like, I will do it again. So you'll have an opportunity because it was a great afternoon of hanging out with a bunch of like-minded folk talking all kinds of different tech stuff. Some people, you know, pushing other people on their perspectives, but all in a super friendly, very cordial manner. Even the beard managed to hang out for a bit and do some chatting.
What a surprise.
It was really cool to hang out with everybody. And it reminded me what an amazing difference it is when you have these things in person. So maybe one day a little barbecue here at the Jupiter Broadcasting Studios will turn into like a massive live event.
I don't know if I'm supposed to be saying this or not, but I heard some scuttlebutt of maybe doing it every 6 months.
There was talk of that. Yeah, if people be willing to make the trip. Yeah, it was good. I mean, the food was so good. So good. And honestly, one of the heavy hitters food-wise, West Payne. Mr. Westbane, brought in some just crazy great brats and a Hawaiian macaroni salad.
Where other than the JB Studios?
He must have brought you, beer, I know.
Could you potentially get barbecue in December?
It was awesome, right? We should. Barbecue in December, why the heck not? It's just, you know, it was a cool way to celebrate Linux Unplugged 200. So you go from, like, these massive mecca events to these little local Linux community things, and it's just great all around. It was really cool.
So last week, I spent my 4th of July out at a farm riding four-wheelers, blowing stuff up, shooting things. It was a great time. And I got to spend some time with a good friend of mine who, he has a very interesting story. He started with absolutely nothing and worked his way up. And he did it all online. He taught all of the skills that he has today online. He was literally a stock boy for Walmart. He was loading groceries in the grocery department. He'd go home, he'd sit down at his computer, and what he'd do is he went over to a site like Linux Academy and leveraged the fact that you can get some really good deals. What's the code? I don't even know what the code is.
You just go to linuxacademy.com/unplugged. That's all you got to do.
Okay,
I like that you use leverage, too. I need to use that more often in my day-to-day language. As I got to say,
you know,
leverage.
I'll tell you what that is. That comes from sales speak. That's what that is.
Yeah, I know it does. No, I like it. Like, I've got leverage on my package. Yeah, it's linuxacademy.com/unplugged. You go there, you get the 7-day free trial. No, keep going. I'm loving it. You already have me raptured.
Okay.
So I'm so raptured right now. Just keep going, Noah.
He got a really great deal on these online training sites.
You're a great deal.
I'm a great deal. Well, he was a great deal. He made the great deal because what he did was he was able to teach himself a set of skills where now he can make $70,000+ a year working at, you know, doing databases, designing them and stuff like that. And it's really encouraging to sit down and talk to this guy because you understand that this could be anyone. Anyone out there could go to linuxacademy.com/unplugged. You don't have to have any previous skills. You don't have to have any previous knowledge. You don't have to know the right people. All you have to do is go to linuxacademy.com/unplugged and you can get started on your next career. It's really fun.
It's finally happening. The Dell User Air Sweepstakes for one of their laptops, an XPS 13. They're going to order it, put it all together brand new for you if you become the winner. Here's how you enter. Go to jupiterbroadcasting.com, click on the shows, drop down and choose User Air. Now, right there in the description of User Air, you'll see a link to fill out a form. You have until July 18th at 11 a.m. Pacific sharp. You have until July 18th at 11 a.m. Pacific sharp, and a winner will be randomly chosen from the entries for a fancy, fresh, User Air approved Dell XPS 13. Super excited about this. Been talking to Dell for a while about doing this. I have one of these. I have an older model. It's such a nice rig because it's got the Infinity display. This is no promo. There's no exchange of funds here. We had an opportunity. We went down to Dell, and they asked us about it, and we've been simmering on this behind the scenes for months, and now it's finally here. We're giving away a brand spanking new, not even my grubby hands all over it for a review, nothing. Brand new from the factory, Dell XPS 13. The sweepstakes is on until July 18th. Just go to our User Air show page. Go to jupiterbroadcasting.com, click shows, User Air. You'll see the link right there at the top of the User Air page.
I don't read a lot of books. I don't really like books. Personally, I'm of the opinion that anything you can get from a book, you can get from a TV twice as fast, or in these days, YouTube video. However, there is one book that I think is really, really great. It's like back from like the 1950s, and it's called Charlie Percy Snow's The Two Cultures. And basically what the book talks about is that we have two ways of approaching society. The first way is the creative way, where we do art and we do music and we do, you know, we talk about like social constructs and stuff like this. And those are all very valuable and great things, but we can't really define success and failure with them. And the other way that we can look at society is in a scientific, hardline way, things like engineering, math, the hard sciences, where we build a bridge, and if the bridge lasts 10 years, then we have a line. If we build another bridge and the bridge lasts 12 years, now that bridge is a better bridge. If the bridge lasts 9 years, then that bridge is not quite as good of a bridge. And so we can define success and failure. And as a society, we need to put a heavier concentration on things that we can define success and failure, because that's how we move forward as a society. We can measure success rather than, you know, just I'm gonna create art because I want to create art. So I threw paint on a canvas, and that's great. And there might be a lot of people that really value that, but it's not that as a society we can't necessarily measure success going forward like that. This is a really interesting book.
Okay, so that seems like exceedingly interesting when you look at it in the world of YouTube and podcast and mm-hmm. and music and TV shows, where there is a few standouts like Game of Thrones or some YouTube videos that are of exceptional high production quality and seem like they're moving the art form forward, whatever the art form is. And then you have the vast, 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 vast majority, which is all horseshit. It's just stupid clickbait. It's lazy people sitting in front of a web camera. It is people mm-hmm. that are reposting stuff. It is people that are podcasting stuff that everybody else has already talked about. Like, it does seem like we have more quote-unquote art today that is art for art's sake than it is actually moving the medium or the method or anything that is like building on top of something else forward. Are you following what I'm saying here?
Yes. And so where the rubber meets the road is then when you go into an education system, how much emphasis should be placed? Certainly we want to include things like music and art because they make us well-rounded human beings. But how much emphasis should be spent on that? How much money should be spent on that as compared to teaching or encouraging or moving towards things that have actual measurable return on investments of, you know, this money or education or time or whatever else?
Well, see, I think that you just brought up the counterpoint to that book's whole argument, because the problem I think with education is the fact that it is measured so strictly, and if you don't meet certain measurements, then it's considered a failure.
I would agree with that if we didn't have federal subsidized student loans or federal guaranteed student loans, because essentially,
well, I'm not even talking about post-secondary education. I'm talking about like high school, middle school, elementary school.
That's even worse because 100% of it is public funded, but at least, you know, assuming we're talking about public education. But you are asking taxpayers then to pay for these things that are highly subjective, right? And may have success or may not. Like, you can teach somebody how the proper, you know, methods of shooting a video and recording proper audio. At the end of the day, content is king. And if that person doesn't have something interesting to present, that content isn't going to gain any traction.
I'm not even talking about the art side. I'm talking about the, like, the math and the sciences side, though.
Okay. Like, you don't think we should have as much of an emphasis?
I think we should have a strong emphasis on those, but I don't think we should have as much of an emphasis on trying to specifically line up what is a success and a failure in those.
So how do you then quantify that?
Yeah.
Why does it need to be quantified?
Okay.
Because we're spending money on it.
Yeah, I mean, so the whole idea is you invest in something. It's interesting this has gone to education already, because I think you could have a conversation about the arts and their value in general. But, okay, so we'll look at it from a different angle. What exists after you die?
Your legacy, I would say.
Right, and I would think that the arts do actually play a pretty big role in something that captures the state of humanity at that time. So there could be an argument that
I agree with that
having a million expressions of art is better than just having one or two, even if 900,000 of them are crap.
Because it gives a better context.
Maybe. Like, if you ask what we're really leaving behind, maybe there is an argument to spend money there. I think the problem is what I would like to see is how about education of recognizing quality? Because there seems to be a lack of ability to determine something of quality versus something that's total crap.
I agree.
I think part of that is the every child gets a trophy kind of idea, right? Like, if we take somebody and, you know, Billy does an art project that's actually really good. Like, the dog looks like a dog and the tree looks like a tree and all of this stuff matches up, and you say, okay, Billy did a really good job. And then, you know, Frank over here, and I'm just making these names up, obviously, but, you know, Frank over here, his tree is just like a brown line, and his sky is just scribbly blue stuff. I think it's okay, I think it would speak to the idea of recognizing quality if we say, okay, Billy did a better job than Frank, and so we need to – everyone that wants to do art, you know, at this, you know, elementary level needs to seek to be more like Billy and less like Frank. Frank needs to be more like Billy because Billy's been doing a better job.
See, but I don't agree with applying quantification to art because art is completely subjective.
I agree.
Just because it's not good to you doesn't mean it's not good to someone else.
I agree with you. However, you at the end of the day, you have to be able to create a market for that art. And one of the things you're seeing, especially in the U.S. and society in the U.S., is they're talking about subsidizing art. Like, that's a big discussion right now, right? Which is idiotic if you think about it, because what that is that right. So we're essentially saying government gets to decide what is art, and then more importantly, it gets to decide what art isn't. And so, you know, when the government has to sell your tickets to your show, then how good is your show, really? And so I think that there is value in saying, you know, in a first grade class or kindergarten class, you hold up someone's art. If 80% of the kids in the school like it, well, then you have appealed to something, even if it doesn't necessarily look like a tree or a sky or something like that. I do think there is value there. But I think that
you shouldn't quantify if art is good or not in classrooms. I think that you should let people do as they will and try to guide them in a direction that everybody has decided is good. But I feel like the market itself will decide if that art is worthy or not after.
So I somewhat agree. Here's a thought that just occurred. This might go a little ways off into the weeds, so you can drag me back if it is. But it always bothered me in school when we would sit down for literature class and a teacher would read me a book and then tell me what the book meant. Or we had to read the book and then she would tell me what the book meant. Like, I never understood why somebody feels like they're in a position to interpret a work of art better than I can myself. Because you've read it multiple times, or because you have been taught by other people who thought that they could interpret it, now you're in some sort of a position to tell me what the author meant when he wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't I read the book and make my own interpretation of what the author was saying?
That's kind of interesting, because I feel like you had a very different English class education than I did, because usually we were told to read the books and then we gave the teacher our interpretations and we discussed the different interpretations.
Ah, but we kind of did that. But did the teacher ever tell you you were wrong? Like, no, you didn't understand this correctly. That's not what they were saying. This actually meant this.
No, right? Not really. Actually.
Oh, really?
Oh, we did.
They tried to understand how we got to the interpretations we did, and then tried to connect that to the overall lesson.
Yeah, I feel like your public education system might have been a little better than ours.
Over to DigitalOcean.com and use our promo code Here's the Thing. One word, you apply it to your account. DigitalOcean.com, create the account. Here's the Thing. Now, what is DigitalOcean? It's like super great Linux infrastructure on demand. I love it for anything I want to test or anything I want to put in production, or if I'm over at a wedding with Russians, perhaps I want to throw something in that we'll all post our photos on afterwards. And it was super simple to get started, because it's not like I'm like spending hours doing this stuff. In less than a minute, I have a rig spun up, and then I one-click a deployment of an open source application, which is a cute way of saying they deploy an Ubuntu LTS system, they get it all up to date, they manage the partitions correctly, they set up all of the repos for the external third-party open source project that I'm going to use, they make sure it's the correct GBG keys, and then they slam it all onto a system within seconds. It's amazing. If you use our promo code Here's a Thing, you get a $10 credit. You can try out their $5 rig 2 months for free, or use the 3 cents an hour machine, which is the one I love. It's not even their cheapest machine, but it's a monster in terms of performance. And right now, DigitalOcean is introducing object storage. You can sign up for early access and get a terabyte. DigitalOcean.com, create the account, use our promo code Here's the Thing. And then once you're kind of like, I'm not sure what else to do, I'm not sure, go over to their community section. They got great documentation. DigitalOcean.com, promo code Here's the Thing. We could talk about the laptop survey, although I don't really actually have much to say about it. So Lenovo at 40% of the Lenovo at 40% of the market, Dell coming in at 30% of the market, Asus at 16, HP at 15.
I was thinking about this, but I'll tell you what a big part of Lenovo. I was thinking about this. I was like, I work in this industry, so why do I see so many Lenovos? And here's the answer. You know what the answer is? There are people at high level, at making high level decisions that get influenced, and then it jacks up that number. I'll give you the best example I can think of off the top of my head, because it's pretty publicly known, so I don't think I'm violating any sort of NDA. Amazon, they they have to, you, if you go, if you contract to go put in machines at Amazon, they have a specific model and a specific RAM, specific hard drive and all that stuff. And it's all mandated that it's Lenovo. You can't, you can't mix and match. You can't say, well, Dell has a better price, whatever. Like they want, they have specific models that you can choose from and install and stuff like that. So like, it, when you get one person or the right person in the right business, and all of a sudden hundreds of thousands, if not millions of machines are purchased from Lenovo for that company. And that, that's just one. Wyndham is another great example. They mandate Lenovo machines. So every Wyndham property across the entire country.
But I mean, you don't have anybody mandating what you buy, and you're still buying Lenovo machines to run Linux.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, I mean, I think that it's not so much like, oh, Lenovo makes such a great machine that people choose to X. Like, honestly, the customer experience.
Like, I would bet I would bet a ton of Linux installs come from on corporate machines. They go into corporate machines and they're installing whatever work bought them.
That's the whole reason that Lenovo bought IBM's laptop line back in the day, so they could get all those people for free.
Yes. Probably. Yeah.
So Dell, though, who has only really been in the consumer hardware space for a little while now, is at a pretty solid 27.8%.
Yeah.
That is from going 2 years, 3 years from now ago, from zero to almost 30%. That is remarkable. That's a remarkable growth. Apple, as you would expect, Apple and Acer are tying in at fifth with only 11.3% of the installs. And you know what? More people are running Linux on a MacBook than I honestly expected. A lot of masochists out there. And then, by the way, as one of those masochists, System 76 was the most popular dedicated Linux system provider. And only 2.1 of the 30,000 respondents, only 2.1 of these Linux enthusiasts, only 2.1 of these people that are buying computers to run Linux on them, only 2.1% said they were using System 76. And I'm trying to wrap my head around what that means exactly, because 2.1% would be a devastating figure if this was the general PC market and they were looking at buying brands. But when you ask Linux experts and enthusiasts who are on Linux news websites, and this did get a widespread. It wasn't just for Onyx. It got a widespread. And only 2.1% of those 30,000 people who are Linux users are running on System 76. I honestly can see why they're making some bold moves and launching things like Pop! OS and trying to make some noise, because I sure would like that to be at 10% if I was them.
I think there's a couple things that play into that. First of all, I think that there's a large Linux penetration that exists outside of the U.S., and I think that, at least from last I spoke, I hear from people all the time that have had difficulty getting their machine shipped if they live outside the U.S., ordering from System 76. I don't know if that's still the case. Maybe they fixed that, but at least as of 8 months ago, that was still an issue for some people.
But figure this, Noah. This predominantly went out to people speaking English.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, speaking English? I mean, I think most of the people, I don't know that English is, you know, pretty pervasive even internationally, but I think that plays somewhat of a thing if you're in, you know, even in, you know, Europe or Japan or China or whatever, and you want this machine, you can't get it. The second thing is, I think that a large number of people don't buy brand new machines. They buy secondhand machines, and it's much easier to find a ThinkPad on eBay that you can run Linux on than it is to buy a System 76. So people that work for companies and they have a corporate issued laptop, sure, no problem. They'll probably buy System 76. Or you're buying, you know, a lot of them. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So is it possible that 2.1% is a pretty large representation of the enthusiast market at home that's just buying Linux dedicated machines?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like I was saying in the chat, it would be interesting if we could compare that and look at it on a graph as far as growth or decline, right? So if we see that 2.1 is, you know, it's up from 1.0 last year, well, that's huge. Then the growth is they've doubled their sales. On the other hand, if they were at 5%, now they're down to 2%, well, now they're tanking, and I would be devastated. So I think you've got to look at that.
I totally follow you there, like looking at last year's numbers. But the point that the beard brought up earlier, what did you say, Rikai? You said it's been 11 years.
Yeah. System 76 has been a company for 11 years, and they still have a very small market penetration, from what it seems like.
Yeah, when you survey Linux users, you would think it, after 11 years, that would be a higher number.
Maybe. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It would.
I think it's kind of funny. Hold on. I think you should make a full disclosure. Like right now, like your last laptop you bought was a Lenovo.
Oh yeah.
Not a System 76 machine. So it's kind of funny that you're arguing this point.
No, what I'm arguing is, and I can give you the exact reasons why, but I don't. So it's interesting because from a System 70, you know, said they've been in business for 11 years, so they should have more market penetration. But look at the amount of capital that Lenovo spent over the last 11 years. Look at the amount of capital that Dell has spent over the last 11 years. And then look at the amount of capital that System 76 has spent over the last 11 years. And then look at the amount of customers they've gained per dollar.
Sure.
And I think what you'll find is that System 76 – this is speculation. I don't know. But my guess is dollar per user, System 76 probably has a higher return on investment.
If that was true, though, I think that same logic would apply to all of the vendors, not just System 76. And if you use your same logic, Apple should be way higher in the list.
Well,
Apple should not be coming in at fifth or fourth.
So
they should be coming in at number two.
So I think there's a couple hard lines. The first hard line is, like, again, I go back to that corporate issue standard, this is the build you're going to use. I think that accounts for 85%, if not higher, of choices. Like, they don't even get a choice. It doesn't even matter what they want to use. They're not using Mac, they're not using Linux, because whatever company tells them you're using this Lenovo machine, it pre-installed with Windows.
You just take a percentage and you say, you just got assigned a machine.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, those people don't even count because they didn't even really get a choice. And those companies they're making decisions. What's up?
Isn't this the desktop Linux survey, though, not the workstation Linux?
No, it's laptop.
Linux?
It's laptop survey. Laptop survey.
Yeah, I mean desktop way, Linux, I mean, like Linux on the desktop.
In the last 2 years, it's kind of irrelevant because in the last 2 years, I don't think we've sold a large organization desktop computers. I mean, they're all using laptops, you know, with USB-C docks or regular docks, whatever.
Well, I meant desktop in the concept of desktop Linux, not like physical desktops.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I think that's largely why Apple hasn't penetrated more. I think that's largely why Linux hasn't penetrated more. Because if you look at the number of installations that we see where their applications are literally a web browser, there is zero reason. There's every reason not to be using Windows for that particular install. And yet these companies mandate that, you know, you have Windows 10 or whatever, and you're going to run Chrome and you're going to go to this website. Well, there's it just doesn't make any sense, right? Like, you could do it on a Chromebook, you could do it on Mac, you could do it on a Linux machine.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm digging and I'm following what you're saying, and I think you're on a sound path here. But my question then be, let's flip this on its head for a second. If because I agree, like, you even look at Hadea's business, dude. Even like super complicated stuff that, you know, requires talking to local hardware is being done on the web browser now. It's amazing, and she's doing it all under Linux, and she's been doing it under Linux. How long ago do we switch her to Linux? It's been like more than a year now that we switched her to Linux.
Yeah, but if we had, if we weren't there, she'd be on a Windows machine.
Sure, yeah, but my point is, like, you're right. Like, so much of this stuff, it doesn't really matter what the OS is. It's more about what you can do in the browser. And so if we hold that to be true, then is the type of hardware you run it on more important than ever? Like, the stability, the performance, the cost, the reliability of the hardware, does it become even more important now than the conversation about what the operating system is? Because the operating system, in some sense, becomes irrelevant. It becomes more of a conversation of what is your web browser and how reliable is your hardware, don't you think?
So interesting you bring that up. We actually, and I talked about this a little bit on the Ask Noah show, and I've since watched it kind of explode, but there's a company called N1 Computing. And they make what the 2017 equivalent of a thin client is, and it connects out to a central managed machine, which has then little virtual workstations in it. And after I covered it on the show, I got in contact, and we were talking about how they tie into these different services. And the level of integration with Libvirt and Libvirt D and stuff is absolutely incredible. And it speaks to exactly what you're talking about. You have servers in the back room that have high availability. It's a high availability cluster. And then you literally have these tiny little throwaway $150 boxes that you give everyone that then sign into this high availability cluster. So when you have a hardware failure is not if you're going to have it, it's when you're going to have it. When you have a hardware failure, take the box, throw it in the trash, plug a new one in, go back to work. And you've never lost any of your work because it was all saved inside of the session. And you're not losing the downtime is the amount of time it takes you to plug an HDMI cable and two USB cables in. And I think it's interesting as you're watching the industry. We started with what we call back in like the 80s, we called them dumb terminals. And now we have advanced into, I have a hard drive in my computer and I can do everything right here on this independent box. And now we have shifted back to Azure and Amazon AWS and the cloud. And we've gone back to this, you know, this network-based infrastructure. It's very interesting to watch.
It's because it's so freaking practical from a cost standpoint, because you invest in the infrastructure and then you just essentially roll the client side over and over again. Just like the humans sitting at the machines are just cogs in the machinery, now these are just cogs too. Everything's a cog and they're all replaceable, except for that infrastructure.
You look at the cost, right? Like, let's say you buy a copy of Photoshop, right? And you have three graphic designers. Well, maybe only one of them is working at any one time. So you can set this cluster up. So when somebody clicks on the Photoshop icon, it instantly launches an RDP session or whatever, a window session with your Adobe, Photoshop license. And now that person can use it. She closes it off. And we obviously start thinking about it at that scale, right? You have 200 graphic designers and you have 50 licenses or whatever. So 50 people can use it at any one time. It becomes incredibly cost effective. And then you're not dealing with backups and stuff of individual machines, because it's all centralized, and from an administration standpoint, it's outstanding. So we're doing a lot of this now, and it's a very interesting trend in technology.
I'm going to put a link in the show notes for you to check out if you want later on. Something I've been playing with for JB is putting a Windows machine somewhere on the network, or maybe in KVM, and then using an open source project called Moonlight. I've talked about it on Linux Unplugged recently. It's moonlight-steam.com, and you can point this thing at executables on a Windows box, Explorer or Photoshop.exe or whatever, and it uses NVIDIA-accelerated video encoding to send you a live stream of the application to your Linux box or a Raspberry Pi. Yeah, man. So instead of virtualizing, you burn one machine and you put Windows on it. But then that one Windows machine is a full-fledged Windows desktop with full acceleration, DirectX, everything. And then you use the Moonlight project to stream the applications you need to the Linux box or an Android device. And so my thought was, what if we just did one machine on the network, then that's where Photoshop and After Effects and those things ran, so that the few times, like the 12 times a year that I need After Effects, we could just stream it to the machine I'm sitting at. And so I started playing around with moonlight-stream.com, and I'll have a link in the show notes if you guys want to check it out. And we've covered it in Linux Unplugged, and I got emails in from listeners that said, yeah, I run the full Windows desktop. I project the Windows desktop. I point Moonlight at explorer.exe, and I have my Linux users log in, and when they need something on Windows, they just run this stuff. It's pretty cool. And I was thinking this might be a way I deliver Windows games to my kids, too.
Interesting is you're talking about putting it on physical hardware. I think what I would do is I would use libvirt-d and pass through a GPU.
That was on the back of my mind. Yeah, but I just feel like it would take more time for me to set that up. But that was sort of in the back of my mind.
These days, if you get the right hardware, it's literally a checkbox. But invert manager. But here's the thing: it's interesting. I hate Windows with the best of them, right? Like, you're never going to find it. There's no record of Noah saying anything positive about Windows. But I got to tell you, if you take Windows and you virtualize it into a hypervisor, and you have that hypervisor supports things like snapshots and rollback and stuff like that, man, it is unbelievably usable. Like, because everything that you expect to go wrong, like, and I'll give you a perfect example. Last week, working with a client, they have a completely virtualized Windows infrastructure. We installed the latest version of Nuance PDF Reader. Like, who would have thought that would be a problem? Whole machine blue screens. Like, can't even boot it. And so they're freaking out because, I know, right? It's a PDF viewer. I mean, I can understand how that would tank your kernel. So they're freaking out because in the past, what this has meant when the machine blue screens is it means that Noah has to drive out to them, and it's going to take a day to reinstall. And I'm like, you know what? Not an issue. I open up Virt Manager. I click on the thing. Go into snapshots before Nuance install. Rollback. Click. Okay, there we go. All right, start it back up. There we go. Back online. Like,
you want
30 seconds.
You want to know something, man? This is my prediction. And I don't know how long I have to wait around in podcasts for this to play out, because I feel like I'm 5 years into it. But almost 5 years ago, it's not quite been that, but almost 5 years ago, I made a prediction that at some point in time, Microsoft is going to break. They're going to break from Windows, and they're going to launch an entirely new operating system. And what they're going to do is they're going to have Windows 10 or whatever it's going to be, Windows Legacy is what they'll probably call it, running in a VM. And you're just going to – all of the shit problems you have with a Windows box are just going to kind of go away, because they're going to create a new operating system that's going to be totally ripped off from Linux, except for it won't be Linux because they can't touch the GPL at that level. But it's going to be a total ripoff of the best stuff from the Mac and the best stuff from BSD and the best stuff from Linux. And they're going to launch Windows 20 or whatever it's going to be
called. Microsoft BSD.
Yeah, and then in VM, when you double-click an ICSI that's like, you know, a decade old, in the background, it's going to instantaneously spin up a Windows VM, and it's going to emulate the entire Windows back end and run that application for you. And I think, because I agree.
You are not that far off.
Once you run Windows in a VM, it's obvious that that trash can of an operating system just needs a little belts and suspenders and maybe a diaper, and it's not that bad to use.
That you are spot on, and I'll tell you another reason why I think you're absolutely right is because I think Microsoft fundamentally needs to change their model. They needed to offer the whole Windows 10 as the last operating system, blah, 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 because now we can compete with Apple and all these other companies, and nobody's paying $200 for an operating system anymore. And right. that'll work for a little bit, and that will work while people buy new machines and while people upgrade to Windows 10. But what happens when everyone has all of their Windows 10 licenses? Mm-hmm. Then what?
Yeah.
And I have said this from day one of the Ask Noah show. They have to go to a subscription model. And the way they do that is something like you're talking about where you have a managed cloud Azure operating system.
Maybe you even install it from the store, dude. You install it from the store.
Yes.
So maybe a yearly subscription.
Yes, $20 a month or something like that, and then they have, you know, maybe it comes with a licensed copy of Office, and it comes with...
Yes, of course it would, because they're not even going to port their own stuff. They're so slow. So they're going to have... If you want to run Office, you're going to have Windows Legacy for $20 a year or month or whatever it's going to be. Of course that's what they're going to do.
I think you're already starting to see that too in Windows 10 because they've already got the different update tracks that you can put your system on.
Right. You've got the Insider program. You've got the mainline. And there's several tracks, actually. Yeah. You're right. And it's sort of like the whole branches of OS releases.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're onto something. By the way, side note, it's really frustrating that they call it like 1704 or 1604, whatever it is. Like, it's not quite. It's like one number off or whatever. But every time I hear somebody talk about like, oh, I'm on Windows, I'm on the 1604 build or whatever, I'm like, wait, what?
Oh, yeah, that's their build numbers. Like that's not like they planned it like that. That is actually a coincidence.
It's just coincidence.
It's
really frustrating, though. People call it Windows. Because the thing is, build numbers were really never important before, but now that there's Windows 10, but there's like lots of different kinds of Windows 10, so the build number is actually kind of important. But like, you hear people, they're like, yeah, I'm running 1604. I'm like, really? Yeah, latest version of Windows 10.
Like, if you really thought about it, who is in a better position to virtualize Windows than Microsoft? Because they could probably, like, share the kernel. They could do some more. It would probably be more akin to containers than it is actual virtualization. So the overhead would be pretty low. So, you know, you got to load up all the 32-bit Windows 10 libraries. I bet you load those once. You don't load those per application. So they could have some secret sauce at the virtualization/containment level. And then when it comes to 3D acceleration, who better to 3D accelerate a virtualized Windows environment than Microsoft themselves? They could probably pass the virtualized Windows application right through the display manager of the current desktop, all DirectX the entire way through, nice, spick-spanning quick. And this is going to happen. And I've been sitting back and waiting for them to actually realize it now for like almost 5 years, because in my mind, This is a foregone conclusion. It solves the x86 and ARM problem. It solves the Windows as a legacy operating system problem. It allows them to use Windows better on the Azure cloud because some of the same technology will probably adopt on the Azure cloud.
Well,
this is a win-win.
They're probably using all the Azure stuff to work out some of these problems.
Yeah. You could even have an on-demand back-end Windows infrastructure that runs on Azure in a privatized virtualized cloud that's locked to your Microsoft ID that is encrypted and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's perfect, man. And it just needs your credit card.
It's honestly just the next evolution of where they've already gone. I mean, first they cloudified domain controllers. Then they cloudified Exchange. Like all the things that they used to sell as local service, Office 365.
Yeah.
Everything they used to sell as local services, they have now turned into a service, software as a service. And the last thing remaining is just the base OS. You do that, and all of a sudden now you just have monkeys giving you $20 a month.
Desktop as a service.
It's desktop as a service.
I really think he's onto something. And here's the thing. Like, Google has kind of tried to do that with Chrome OS, and the reason that they failed is because they don't have the market penetration for apps that Microsoft has. And Microsoft, they don't have that problem.